Now I have your numbers. Thanks.
Hey, I'm Robbie Kramer. You're listening to the Leverage Podcast, where we discuss using your social skills to hack dating, travel, finding your dream job, and becoming a complete man.
Okay. You're in Turkey right now?
Yeah.
How long are you there?
I'll probably be here in, who knows, because of the Ukraine situation.
Okay, so that's why you went to Turkey. You're just trying to stay clear for a bit till things cool down.
We were gonna come anyways.
Okay,
but it just kind of worked out even better because, you know, now all the Americans that I know that are there are basically peacing out. So
really, okay,
yeah,
okay. And is it a temporary thing, or are they just like, fuck this, I'm coming home for good?
No, I think temporary.
Okay.
You know, I was just hoping, you know, it doesn't happen and
yeah,
kind of blow over.
Okay. So it is like, for the folks that are there, yourself included, it is like a real possibility. It's not just hot air. Like you're like really considering that that might happen.
Well, I think a lot of it is like the American media, right?
Yeah.
None of the Ukrainians I know, either they're not worried about it or they're like, what can we do?
Yeah.
Right. But I don't think the news is sensationalized nearly as much there about it. Like, you know, America needs fucking like news, you know, to run. So they're just running that shit 24/7.
Yeah.
So everyone that I know at first is like, yeah, no big deal. Cause they were always talking to Ukrainian people, but then all their family and friends from America started like pressing them and asking them, like every fucking person I know is basically asked me like, well, are you still in Ukraine? Are you out? Right? Like every American. And then I never hear Ukrainians talking about it amongst each other.
Yeah.
Then again, you know, it's not like my Russian's very good to pick up on it, but I don't really know why that is.
Yeah. So. I mean, it would have to be a pretty bad scenario for you to still not be able to just be like, I think I'm going to leave later, you know? Like, I mean, it's not like they're going to stop you from leaving or harass you or anything necessarily. I mean, I don't think that they would have much to benefit from that. I mean, they're already, if they actually start invading it, they're already out on a limb quite a bit, you know, internationally speaking. The last thing they want to do is start fucking with foreigners and stuff like that. Like, but you know, who knows? Like, but that's cool. Turkey's awesome, man. I love Turkey.
Yeah,
I want to go back.
This place is amazing.
Are you in Istanbul or?
No, I'm in like southern Turkey, just outside of Antalya.
Okay. Okay, cool. So like near the border or
like
in the middle?
No, like western side, like
okay.
North of Cyprus.
Okay. Okay, got it.
Yeah.
I've heard it can get pretty hairy. Like you start going east, southeast, like near the border, the Syrian border, it gets pretty crazy down there. So
really?
Yeah. Yeah, there was a while there where it's like you don't want to be around there because it was like kind of like an active war zone. But yeah, I've been like 2/3 of the way down the coast. There's like a resort town called Kushadesha. I spent like a week there. It was really cool. But I've actually never been inside, like in the interior either. I really wanted to go see all those cool like mountains and stuff.
Cappadocia.
Yeah.
Cappadocia, however you say it.
Yeah,
yeah, I want to. Maybe, I mean, everyone says you got to do it, but it's like a 6 or 7 hour drive from here.
It is. Yeah.
Oh,
it's a long way.
Maybe we'll do it on the way to Istanbul or something.
Yeah.
I mean, before we jump in, I'm just going to ask you the questions that I kind of want to ask,
go for it,
I guess.
Man.
And I think a lot of people will likely be in a similar scenario sort of knowledge wise that I am.
Yeah.
And, yeah, we'll just go from there. And Ozzy, if you have any questions, feel free to, of course, chime in. Like more questions are the better. So, what up, everybody? Today we've got an awesome dude who's gonna school us on crypto. He's a member of the Leverage Group. He's been around and given me some amazing, not just crypto advice, but just all around investing advice. And that's Aaron. Aaron, welcome to the call.
Thanks, man. Happy to be here. Should be fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking forward to picking your brain about this stuff because, you know, I got started in crypto investing, luckily back in probably, I think it was like 2014, 15. Mm-hmm. I had someone owed me some money and they paid me in crypto. I didn't really think about it. And then when 2017 happened, when it ran up, where's that? That was 2017, right?
Yeah.
That little money became a lot of money. And yeah. I got a good tip from a buddy. He was like, it's going to hit 20,000 and it's going to crash after that. And I'm like, all right, well, I just basically collected, you know, right around six figures almost for nothing. So I cashed out, you know, it was life-changing money at that point. And, you know, and then when crypto went back down to, you know, right around like between 3 and 8, I started buying some more, and then just kind of held. And then we had that run up, you know, recently in May, 2021. And then since then, the markets have been kind of up and down and all around. You know, I don't even try to trade because I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. It was just purely luck that my friend told me to, you know, cash out when I did. And then I just listened to, you know, smart people and decided to buy some more. I figured it would go back up. But, you know, that's kind of my personal crypto story. But now the crypto markets and that whole thing has really changed a lot. Like, it's not just about fucking buying and holding or buying and trading, whatever. There's DeFi, which I know it stands for whatever, deregulation. NFTs. There's all this shit that I just don't know what it is, even though I've been around crypto. Yeah. So I was hoping to kind of pick your brain and, you know, why don't you just give a little backstory, I guess, on your experience and why you decided to get into it. And even what is, I mean, other than an investor, you know, as far as I know, it's not like you work in crypto or anything like that. No. So, yeah.
No, just, I work in tech and in video games. And so I think, interestingly enough, I didn't realize this at the time, but a lot of the guys who are big on crypto Twitter and who have been successfully trading or investing in the space for some time got their start in video games, games like RuneScape and, you know, Ultima Online and stuff like this. They played these video games where there were digital economies. And so I think that transition into what we jokingly refer to as magic internet money was like a more graceful transition for them. Like, I think they could wrap their heads around it a little easier. Whereas like even now, at this moment, I think that there are a lot of, to be a little bit dismissive, like boomer types who are like super dismissive of this stuff as just being valueless and nonsense and just a way for the rich to get richer or whatever the narrative is. My experience with this is interesting in that I didn't get involved with it super early. When I was at Riot, I had a couple buddies that were farming or that were mining Bitcoin on like their Minecraft servers. When we weren't playing on their Minecraft servers, they would swap them over to Bitcoin mining machines. And this was back in like 2011 when Bitcoin was like less than a buck. A couple of those guys would just like leave thumb drives lying around with Bitcoin on them. And then like, obviously like 6-7 years later, they were like scrambling, like digging through old dirty laundry in their closets and stuff, trying to find these fucking thumb drives. But I didn't really understand it or pay much attention to it. I mean, they were engineers. They were involved in all kinds of zany experimental stuff at the time. So it didn't ever strike me as like anything to actually take seriously. I was kind of raised as like a traditional finance person, like, well, you need to buy gold and silver and that's how you sort of protect your money and all this stuff. And so I actually have, you know, like a bunch of bars of silver and stuff like this that I bought, you know, at terrible timing when the big, you know, silver and gold bull market happened in like 2010. And interestingly, I think there's a lot of those folks, a lot of the more like libertarian types that have sort of naturally flowed into things like the Bitcoin culture. I got in because of the macro folks that I was following, folks that were traditionally into like, you know, normal stock index investing and emerging markets and stuff like this, who started talking about crypto in like 2018, 2019. And a guy I particularly follow closely named Raul Powell was basically like, when the COVID crash happened in 2020, he's like, go all in. He's like, this is your moment. He's like, this is like a generational bottom type situation. And so I did. And it turned out really well. And in the beginning, it became it was a way for me to sort of try to rapidly and aggressively expand my portfolio with high risk assets. And as I started to learn more about it, I became kind of enamored with the story behind it and the culture behind it and what was actually changing. And to your point now, it's gone so far behind gone so far beyond Bitcoin and now become this like whole new digital asset class that people are just discovering the use cases of. And that discovery is still an ongoing process. And I think a lot of the reason why there's a lot of controversy and frustration and confusion around this stuff is because the reality is we're all still figuring it out. Like I went to a crypto conference a couple months ago, and even the guys who are like, yeah, I have 200 Bitcoin, like no big deal. They're still learning like what it is. Like, I don't think anyone really actually understands what it is. You just have leading theories of competing levels of efficacy, basically. Like, I've been thinking about this and I wrote a book, but, you know, you look at the book more closely and you're like, yeah, a lot of this is debatable. You know what I mean? But this shit's only been around for 10 years. So I think that's what's so exciting about it. And the last thing I'll say is back to your story. I hear a lot of those stories where it's like, you know, my buddy paid me back in Bitcoin back in 2013 as a joke. He's like, check this out. It's cool. I have another friend here in Denver who had the same story and it blew up and became a lot of money. And I think it's worth noting that there are a lot of younger folks that have experienced something like that. And I think that that's magical because we live in a world now where it's actually quite difficult for a young person to have that kind of a story. Like a rags to riches story. It doesn't happen as much anymore. You know, a lot of millennials are living at home with their parents, struggling to make ends meet, crippled with a lot of debt. It's refreshing a little bit to hear a story where it's like, yeah, you know, I made 100K out of nowhere. Like there's something beautiful about that. And I think that gives a lot of hope to the younger generation that there might actually be a way for them to make enough money to retire one day, you know? So anyway.
Yeah, they're, you know, I agree. It is kind of a cool thing that happened to a lot of people. And then unfortunately, so many people that I've heard stories like that, you know, they didn't sell when it, you know, when it hit 20 and they held on. But I mean, if they did held on, they're even better than they were, right? Because obviously it's worth more than 20 now. Yeah. You know, I know one guy who basically he had like, I don't know, 20 Bitcoin and he just never sold. And he's just ridden the wave the entire way. He's like, I'm never selling. Yeah. if you never sell, you never actually make money. Right.
That's true. There's a subculture there now, around Bitcoin specifically, which is like the never sell culture, which is like, you're almost you're opting out of the US dollar denominated system in theory. I mean, the reality is no one's taking Bitcoin to pay your electric bills. So you can't really opt out. But like, I think that there's folks that are really trying to do that where they're in their minds when they go to work, they're almost farming for fiat currency so that they can immediately turn it over into Bitcoin. And that whole culture has like a lot of politics and a lot of sort of like, it's wrapped up in a bunch of things. It's very intense. Like the folks that are in that sort of bubble are like really feverishly devoted to it. Mm-hmm. And the folks that are outside that bubble are like, you guys are crazy nut jobs. But I actually think it's a good thing overall, that there's culture associated with this stuff. I think that's one of the biggest things that makes me bullish on crypto long-term is how there's developing subcultures and memes and all this stuff around digital assets. Because community and adoption actually is the thing driving the value now, in this space. And it's worth noting that like for people that have difficulty wrapping their heads around like why this stuff has value, remember that back in 2005, when social media started to become a thing, when MySpace started to pop up and Facebook started to pop up, we all said the same thing about that stuff. We were like, how are these companies ever going to make money? It's all fluff. It's a bunch of people sharing cat pics. Where's the value there? Like, why would I invest in that? And a lot of people got caught unawares when these social media companies now today are actually just the biggest media companies in the world and the biggest tech companies in the world. As it turned out, we all learned the hard way that when you have a large community, when you have a billion people using your product, monetization can come after that. Yeah. You know, and so that, and that's backwards, right? We always believed that you had to have a good product that you could physically sell and then the people would come. Now the people come and then the value follows. That's the new world order. And that's really hard, I think, especially for the older generations to wrap their heads around.
Yeah, I think so too. So if that holds true, it would seem that, you know, given crypto's, you know, banking, it's an asset, it's, you know, digital currency. You know, if these, I don't know, tokens or companies or whatever, I don't even know what you would call them, could, you know, potentially replace the banking industry or something like that. That would be the equivalent, you think?
Yeah. I mean, it's a shift in where the value lies. So like you have companies like BlockFi or Coinbase, right? Mm-hmm. That are going to certainly have roles in this new world order. You know, Coinbase is already, I can't even remember. It's an insanely valued company. It's like double digit billions, like 50, 70 billion, something like that, maybe more now. So there will be these companies that rise up and sort of play the crypto form of the bank. And then you mentioned DeFi earlier. There's emerging frameworks and patterns that don't currently exist. Like you have decentralized exchanges now where it's sort of a peer-to-peer network, essentially, where you can come and trade and exchange assets and store assets and take out loans all without any sort of real third-party involvement. There's sort of more or less like an AI algorithm in the background managing everything. And there are no gigantic banks taking a big chunk off the top as you do that.
So that's what DeFi is, because I really didn't understand what the fuck it is.
Yeah.
So it's decentralized finance.
Decentralized
meaning
finance.
There is no third party guaranteeing the loan, or like as a bank would do.
Yeah. Right? Now there are guarantees in the sense that, like, again, there are frameworks and rules binding the way in which people can exchange funds, but they're all computationally managed as opposed to managed by an organization or a group. Right. And as a result,
the blockchain's managing them with the.
Yeah.
The
or, and also like if I build a decentralized exchange and the blockchains interact with my exchange and people interact with my exchange, my business is actually, if you want to call it that, my business is actually just managing the way in which people interact and the rule sets amongst them. So then there are a ton of sites and groups that do this. And what's interesting about this, again, is like we're used to living in a world where you have to go to like one of six kind of mega banks or one of six institutions that are sort of in the middle of all these international transactions. And you have to work through them and play by their rules and pay their fees. And that's changing quickly. One of the things that I think people find surprising is one of the things you can do now is if you own Bitcoin or Ethereum, for example, you can actually use it as collateral to take loans out against it. And then you can you can play around with the loans. Like you can, let's say you had $100,000 in Bitcoin and you can collateralize a loan of 40%. So you get $40,000 in stable coins or US dollars or whatever you want to call it. You can put that money into some kind of a farm there, where that automated farm is essentially loaning out your money at various interest rates, and it's all algorithmically done. And then you make a yield on that. And everyone who puts liquidity into that farm makes a yield. And what's funny is in this space, an incredibly low risk yield is something like 10%. That's like as low risk as it can get. Like you, if you can't find a 10% stable pool to make money on USD or on stable coins, like you're not doing it right. And what's funny is good luck finding 10% interest anywhere in the normal banking system, right? So this kind of shows you how the disparity here that's emerging between like the digital asset space and like traditional finance.
And you can get that 10% because there's no, you know, third party taking it off.
No middleman. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Now, I mean, again, there's a risk curve here, and the risk curve goes all the way from like you make 8% on BlockFi on your Bitcoin, which you can do relatively safely. Like BlockFi is regulated, it's audited, but you know, all this stuff, to like straight up fucking Ponzi scheme where like they're paying like 25,000% yearly interest. And, you know, the term in DeFi is getting rugged, getting the rug pulled out from under you. And one of these, when the developers that made the thing suddenly just vanish into thin air and nobody knows what happens. And like all of a sudden everyone's selling out and the party's over, right? Like this happens not all the time, but enough to where you have to be really careful about how you approach this stuff. There's definitely like, it's the wild, wild west out there right now for sure.
Got it. That's crazy. So it's even hard to kind of wrap my head around some of this stuff.
It's hard for me. And like, I'm just now starting to get my head around the tools and frameworks and stuff. It's not like, you know, Facebook where there's this UI and it shows you how to do everything and you're safe inside the Facebook bubble. Like you start getting into some of these wallets and tools and, you know, decentralized, you know, bridges and exchanges and swaps. It's just, it's overwhelming. It's the UI is terrible. You can accidentally send $10,000 into the wrong wallet address and lose it all. It's a nightmare. Yeah. So
yeah, it's crazy. So DeFi stands for what it stands for, decentralized finance, correct? Yep. And basically that just means there's no third party involved. It's just the
yeah, more or less. Yeah.
Okay. So here's a question. Let's say what I've been doing and what I think a lot of crypto investors have been doing, you know, first it was just like buy Bitcoin or maybe buy some Ethereum, mm-hmm. right? From what I've heard and what I'm doing is I've got like 50% of my portfolio in Bitcoin, another 25, actually mine's like 50-50 Bitcoin Ethereum mm-hmm. or 40-40, and then maybe 45-45 and then 10% altcoins.
Okay.
My altcoins are basically just like shit people have recommended, mm-hmm. right? And you know, they say if you know nothing but you want to invest in the space, you can just buy Bitcoin, or you can do, you know, 50% Bitcoin, 25% Ethereum, 25% altcoins.
Yep.
You know, and that's before you start dealing with NFTs or DeFi or these other mm-hmm. sort of things. So that's mm-hmm. kind of all I understood after you had just explained the DeFi. I was like, okay, now I understand now how people are using their Bitcoin to make interest in these DeFi. Yeah.
You talk a lot about passive income and you've like given people a lot of great strategies for building that through mm-hmm. real estate and other things. That is now emerging for these assets. And what's great is like, you know, Bitcoin, I think Bitcoin's identity has still been emerging over the last 5 years, regardless of what people say. And one of the things that I've heard it referred to as is pristine collateral, like the real estate of the crypto space. And I think that there's a lot of truth to that. Mm-hmm. And what's great is, again, yeah, you can take loans out against it, or you can, you know, farm with it and loan it out and make a great passive income and then never have to sell it.
Yeah. Just a funny little story. Cause Ozzy is on. So Ozzy was asking me if he should invest in this guy Gunn's crypto fund. And this guy was, he was actually in the group. And he had a fund, it was worth like 60 million. Mm-hmm. And as just a way to diversify, I put like, I think 15 to 20K in there. And I guess what he did was he had like a shitload of the fund in BSV, Bitcoin SV, whatever the fuck that is. And rumor has it, he fell asleep and he like the value like plummeted and he lost his entire fund. Basically the 60 million went to maybe like less than a million, which was, first of all, I didn't understand. Cause at first I was like, okay, my, you know, I bought in for, you know, between 50 and 20. Then all of a sudden my, like I got this email saying your balance is $500. I'm like, well, you know, I haven't seen any of the coins tank that hard. So I still don't really understand what happened. I guess it was kind of like one of those situations where you like buy a put and then it goes the other direction. Then you end up owing money.
Yeah.
Can you explain that? And hopefully, Ozzy, you didn't invest in that fund.
Yeah.
That's so, an example of something that seems safe, but then not.
That's really interesting. BSV wasn't one I was super familiar with, but it sounded familiar. I guess it's an old fork of Bitcoin. So just like really quick, I could be wrong about this. This is just me doing a cursory search, but that's what it looks like. It's marketed as the original Bitcoin. So, back in, like 2016, 2017, there was something called the fork wars where, a lot of the Bitcoin developers were arguing and debating about which direction it should go. And because when you're building a blockchain and when you're managing a blockchain, there's trade-offs to be made. Right? Like a lot of people criticize Bitcoin for being really slow. And the reason that Bitcoin is really slow is because it has like insane levels of security. And so that's a trade-off, right? Like Ethereum is less secure and more decentralized and less decentralized, but is also faster. And then there's others that are even faster than Ethereum. So this is something to keep in mind, but like that looks like a fork. Yeah. And you hear stories like that all the time. Honestly. And that is one aspect of what people talk about when they talk about volatility. We should talk about that more in the second, but your question was more around sort of understanding when you take out leverage.
Yeah, exactly. It was a leverage.
Yeah, when you use leverage. So, okay. So I don't use leverage. I'm just going to say that right off the bat. And I'll be open about the fact that like, I think every investor or every trader should sort of understand what their emotional natural positioning is towards the market. A lot of the reason I don't take leverage is because I'm scared, because I've made enough stupid mistakes in my life to never want to be in a situation that I see some other people end up in where it's like you're getting margin called, which by the way, essentially when you take out leverage, you're essentially, or you're trading on margin, you're essentially borrowing some of what you're trading with. Mm. So that's the way to look at it is right. Like, if you trade 100x leverage, like what that means is if the market moves against you even a little bit, you'll be, asymmetrically wiped out. So if you have one Bitcoin,
you lose what you have, plus you lose what you owe.
What
you owe is going up.
Yeah. Yeah. You can if you borrowed, like you're trading on margin, you can lose what you borrowed, which means you owe money. And you heard some like nasty stories earlier this year of kids trading on Robinhood on margin and like, you know, running in themselves into a lot of trouble and being like, oh shit, I owe $200,000, you know? In the crypto space, it tends to look more like you just lose your entire portfolio, even though you were so convinced that the market was going to move for you. But again, the challenge is, you will make asymmetric gains if the market moves for you. But a lot of folks don't understand like what they call being liquidated is when you're trading on leverage and the market moves against you a little bit, they start locking in some of your crypto as collateral to make sure that you can pay for your liquidation if it happens. And one of the things that one of the things I've realized about the crypto markets, and I feel like people need to understand this, especially if you are like really hot to trot on trying to trade these markets. These markets, there's a cute phrase in the crypto community called max pain. And the idea of it is that the market is almost like this beast waiting to gobble up as many noobs as it possibly can. And I've seen that happen, like these cascading liquidations where like everyone was so convinced we were going to hit the 50,000 support. And so I'm going to long up to that 10x leverage. And then all of a sudden the whole thing just blows out its knee. And like next thing you know, people are screaming, people are getting liquidated. There are like tens of billions of dollars of liquidations. An example is actually just a couple of days ago with this bloodbath we're in right now, there's a large Ethereum holder who had a lot of leverage, and they had, I think, 600 million, and they had to liquidate 60 million to make sure that they didn't actually get liquidated on the rest of their leverage. So, and it was in the news and everything. And it's just like, you just got to be really careful with this stuff. Like, when you're messing with this, you can lose everything. Like, you really can. And you just don't want to be there. Like, don't put yourself in that position. It's super risky. Crypto is in Bitcoin particularly is referred to as an 80 vol asset, which means that, like, what we're seeing right now, a 50%+ drawdown, it just goes with the territory. And it's why a lot of people can't handle it. You have to be able to psychologically and emotionally understand what the consequences are of that kind of an environment. Because, like, right now, I mean, I was one of these guys who was like, I think probabilistically we're going to see a big blow off top at the end of 2021. That was what most people thought. And guess what? The market did its thing again. It max pained the shit out of all of us. And it was like, oh, you think there's going to be a blow off top? How about a 50% drawdown? How about that?
Right.
And now there's a lot of people that lost their shirt in the process, and I'm in pain, but at least, like, I just am a spot Bitcoin and Ethereum holder. So, like, I'm okay. I just have to, like, depend on my income for a little longer. You know what I mean? But there's a lot of people out there who are like, fuck, I mortgaged our house at 65K. It's like, oops, you know, like,
right.
You got to be careful. That's all. Make sure you know what you're doing. And if you don't know what you're doing, start smaller than you think you need to. So
what I've heard is a good strategy. This was prior to the, you know, the recent sort of, you know, run up and then now kind of run back down. But it was like, keep like 5% of your net worth, at least in Bitcoin, just to kind of hedge against the US dollar.
Yeah.
And, you know, it could turn out to be a great investment.
Yeah.
I went a lot more bullish than that. And I'm glad I did, because, you know, overall, Bitcoin's been the best returning investment of all time. Right.
Yep.
You know, we'll see what happens, but
400% year-over-year returns over the last decade.
Same.
On average. Yeah.
So let's switch gears a little bit. Let's discuss NFTs, because, you know, my understanding of NFTs, it's like a fucking JPEG. It's a digital fucking picture or movie, and people are buying and selling these things for fucking millions and millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And I just don't understand. Like, I understand there will be value there, but I just don't understand the value now. It just seems like a bunch of rich kids collecting nonsense. So can you explain that?
Yeah. So there's a lot. And as with anything that's really new, people need to understand that on the one side, there's a speculative mania happening. I don't think you can argue otherwise.
Yeah.
On the opposing side to that, for the folks that are like, this is bullshit, this is Beanie Babies, this is just all going to zero, people always say that. People said that when Amazon first started selling books online. People said that about Bitcoin when it first started getting popular. Like, there's something there. Okay. When a speculative mania arises, it means that there's something there. There's extreme views on both sides, right? There's this is useless, worthless, this is going to zero crowd. And then there's the folks that are like buying up every single ape picture of an ape that they can find and thinking that they're going to be a multimillionaire. Like, these are two extremes. Both of them are wrong, I think, over a long enough term. What I was trying to say is that there's something new and important happening with NFTs, and you don't want to ignore it, because I think it's going to change the way that we interact in a lot of key ways. An example is music rights. Right now, music is something where an artist creates music. Hopefully they get signed by a record label, and then the record label owns distribution rights and decides who makes what. And the record label takes the lion's share of the produce from that, the cash that's made from that. And you have things like YouTubers getting their accounts banned for using a popular song as their background for a couple seconds too long. Well, what if an artist could create NFTs with their songs and lease them or loan them or sell them to anybody that they wanted to with perpetual royalty rights. So an example of something you can do right now with an NFT, if you're an artist, you turn your art into an NFT and you sell it encoded into the way that it's transacted is that you make 6% of whatever the sale price is in perpetuity. Like you don't get that now if you're auctioning your physical piece of art off at some art auction, right? Like once you sell it, and if you're not popular when you're selling it, if you're just trying to make ends meet, you're the definition of the starving artists. It may sell for $5 million some point in the future. You'll never see a dime of that, right? So like this is the kind of stuff that's unlocked for creators out there. It potentially changes the entire landscape and puts a lot of the power and wealth back in the hands of the folks creating the thing, which I think is that's a really huge. Exciting transition.
I didn't understand it until you just explained it so eloquently. And that's fucking huge. I mean, you know, before as far as like a traditional artist, a painter or something like that, like, yeah, you weren't rich until you were long dead.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Go or that sort of thing. Right. But that's a huge game changer.
It is.
Yeah. Essentially, you could, you know, cause you're basically making money off all of your art all the time. If it, you know, as popular as it is. So you're getting, and that really changes the landscape as well, as far as like, cause I'm someone who makes content, you know, and every time I want to use like music on YouTube, as you were saying, mm-hmm. like I can't use that song because of XYZ reason, but now you can basically just buy our portion of the NFT, or you can buy the song and then that pays them back every time I use it without us having to do it.
The right? use cases are there are legion, right? Like, it could be that there's a way for you to like rent the rights to that for the sake of your YouTube channel, or you could actually be part of a fund that invests in certain kinds of music that you might then get rights to as a member of that investing pool or whatever. There's, and again, this is where people are still trying to figure this stuff out. Like there's, you know, big music producers like Timbaland that are getting into this space trying to figure this all out. And it's very new. And that is where I'm like, for the haters out there, of which there are many, I'm like, I understand why you're skeptical, but just keep an open mind, because I really do think that this is going to be game changing over a long enough period of time. I think the speculative mania is freaking people out and turning people off. And that's how all technology starts, right? It all starts with the speculative mania. Like that's why we had a gigantic tech bubble in 2000, was because everyone was just like, you know, I don't care what it is. If it's a tech stock, I'm going to throw my money into it. Well, it's, you know, you have to go through that phase when something's new and hot, you know?
Yeah.
I think another way to look at NFTs is when you start thinking of things in terms of collectibles. Like right now, all the kids that played Pokemon when they were kids are probably familiar with how much those cards are going for, right? Like you have, you know, for the guys out there, I know a lot who are like into sneakers right now. You know, you can buy like legacy sneakers that you pay like super high premium for. And there's like there's a secondary and tertiary market for sneakers right now, of like the right brands and things and the right styles and things like this. It's like, this is, I think the only difference between that. And I think one of the promises of NFTs is that NFTs will code that or harden that into the blockchain, so that where the ownership is and who technically owns it is like contracted. Basically there's a digital contract around it. So like that, there's a collectible market, I think, that's popping up there as well. And that's where things start getting really out there. It's like, well, okay, is that a gaming thing? Is that like trading cards? Is that like art? Like no one really knows right now. And people are just guessing and buying up a bunch of random shit and hoping that, you know, they make money off of it. So yeah, I think that there's a really strong promise there in the future. But right now we just, again, I don't go out and buy a bunch of shit just because everyone else is, because, you know, the winter will come. And unless you're like at the bleeding edge and you understand every aspect of that, like a lot, for example, a lot of the best investors I know, they'll go to a project before it starts, before it's minted, they'll sit in the Discord and get to know the founders and like communicate or participate in the community, and they'll score a bunch of community points. And then when the airdrop comes or the original minting comes, they get a bunch of free shit. So those are the guys that I know that are consistently making tons of money are not like flipping it like real estate. They're actually getting in early, buying shit up cheap, and then selling one out of the 10 things that they bought for a premium later. So just, I don't do NFTs. I have like 15 NFTs, but like I mostly just bought them because I'm like, oh, that's cool. And just to kind of test out the workflows, you know? So.
Interesting. So when you buy an NFT, it just sits in your wallet, right?
Yep. Yeah. I have a bunch of NFTs that are just like, these are sitting in my wallet. Maybe they'll be worth something one day. I thought they looked pretty. That's about it. But
and then what do you
probably pay too like, much for them?
You can put them up on like a, you know, like a picture frame on the wall, like a digital display, and
yeah,
and be like there's an NFT sort of thing. Yeah. Obviously, it's an investment, but
and that market actually, I think is still emerging too. It's like, okay, well, what does it look like to actually display them? Mm-hmm. You know, like Beeple.
Yeah, do yours move and cool shit like that?
What'd
you buy for, can you give us a few examples?
Let me think. I have most of mine are actually static images. Mm-hmm. I don't think I have anything that's like, I have a couple, I have a couple that are like 3D images, but nothing mm-hmm. that's like actually animated.
Got it.
So
I've heard of like, you know, Jordan, for example, getting the original footage of him, you know, cashing a game-winning shot and turning that into an NFT, yeah. right? But you can already, so where's the value for something like that? Because obviously you can just go to YouTube and watch that, right? So,
yeah.
But owning the NFT, it's like, will there be a day where you can't watch that on YouTube unless the NFT owner is getting paid?
So that's an open question, right? Like there's like NBA Top Shot and stuff. It's been super successful where they're selling a lot of that kind of stuff. I don't actually know what their contracts are like what you technically own when you buy the NFT. I'm not super familiar with that, but yeah, again, right now, I think it's just, you own a token, and I would guess that the NBA still has rights over that to use it however they want, but I could be wrong. I think in the future, it does, like, again, the promise I think is this new framework for digital ownership that would allow you to use that or again, lease that out as an investment. So if somebody wanted to use that Jordan video and you owned it, they would have to go through your smart contract, your NFT, and they might have to pay you a royalty for that or something. So that allows, it broadens, like opens up a bunch of new categories for investment, right? And then YouTube might be, again, I'm speculating here, but YouTube in the future might be wired into that, where they can determine if you actually own that thing or not, if you have rights to that thing or not, and make sure the money pipes around and goes where it's supposed to go. So like Twitter, for example, just added a thing for your profile avatar in this last week to be an NFT for you. I haven't tried it myself, but I'm assuming what it does is it talks to the blockchain to validate that you actually own the thing.
Interesting. It kind of reminds me of like Napster, right? When Napster came out, you could just go on there and pirate songs and download every fucking song you wanted. Mm-hmm. And it was free and it was open. And then eventually, like, you know, they shut that shit down because obviously the musicians weren't getting paid anything. Mm-hmm. And they found a way for them to get paid. And this kind of seems like the way that artists could finally get paid for the work they're creating by not getting ripped off, especially like digital stuff. You can rip off digital stuff so easy. You just copy it. Send it.
And interestingly, now, it comes full circle, right? Like where now the artists might actually, including the musicians, might actually embrace the digital asset space. Because if we want to be frank, historically, the record companies have probably screwed over many more artists than the listeners and the consumers ever did. You know what I mean? So it's like, it's like, yeah, they didn't want to pay $17 for your CDs. They stole your songs on Napster. That's what they did. They stole your songs on Napster. But at the same time, how much of that $17 per CD were you getting? Let's ask that question. You know what I mean? Like probably not a lot. So,
right. Yeah, it's like book sales, right? If you're an author and you sell your book to like, you know, Penguin Publishing or whatever, you get, and the book sells for $13, you're getting like less than $1 a book.
Yeah.
So
yep.
Similar sort of situation. Yeah. So it could come full circle where, I'm just kind of thinking out loud here, but would there be a situation where artists could again remove the middleman and just post their art on these NFT exchanges, and there's no longer a need for a recording label or some sort of gallery to show it, right? You can that's basically my understanding of a lot of the blockchain applications, is it removes middlemen. Like Imagine Uber without actually Uber having to be a thing. Like you could look on the blockchain, you could see if a driver has a bad driving record or if they're a convicted felon or whatever, and you can just get a ride from a random dude using the blockchain, and therefore you don't need Uber anymore. So it like essentially, disrupts these middlemen companies in the future.
Yeah. It's, again, there are so many potential use cases. It's almost hard to wrap your head around what they might all be. But yeah, I think the promise here is the idea of decentralization through the blockchain, but having an established set of rules in that blockchain that benefits all of the folks or that they can all agree to and sign up for, opt into. And I think it does, if those functions replicate a lot of the work that these companies do without them needing to be involved, yeah, it's going to be very disruptive. I think places like record labels and publishers could be out of business 10 years from now because of this stuff.
Crazy. I wonder if there's a way to like short those companies. Like, imagine knowing what we knew about Uber, right? If you owned a medallion in New York City, that thing was worth like $100,000. And those were publicly traded on the stock exchange. And if you would have shorted those medallions, you'd be multi-millionaire from just that, right?
Yeah. Think about traditional media companies right now because of social media.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like same thing, right?
Right.
They're very disruptive. Like your newspapers and your, like all these, like everyone's pissed because all these online news publications want to charge you a subscription now to read a news article.
Yeah.
And so I think more and more people are just going to social media to get their news, which has a whole other set of problems, but, it's like, everybody's a newscaster now.
Totally.
Anybody's a reliable source of news now, but like, yeah, again, that kind of disruption for sure. I think we're going to confront that in some way with NFTs and blockchain in the next 10 years.
Cool. Well, that answers, I think, most of my questions. Now I understand this stuff on a whole new level. Thanks so much for explaining it. Let's open up to some other questions from anyone else who's on. If you have a question, just raise your hand. You can go into reactions and do that, and then we'll call on people. And Hugh has a comment. He says, over 1 million for a medallion, 20 cab drivers committed suicide last year, I think, because they couldn't pay back their loans.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Marty, go for it.
Yeah. Could you, what does NFT stand for? And how do you go and look at these exchanges? Like, where do you find them?
Yeah. NFT stands for non-fungible token. Which non-fungible is kind of a wacky way to say it, but more or less it means, again, that there's a smart contract and it's on a blockchain. And if you just want to look around and like get a feel for like what kind of stuff people are messing with, there's a site called OpenSea, OpenSea, like the ocean, OpenSea.com. Check that out.
Okay.
And you can get a feel for it.
So. Cool. Very interesting.
Yeah, crazy shit. Did you buy any of those gorillas or what? Those are like those are like the most valuable NFTs. So, right?
I did not, no. When that stuff was still like accessible, there's people who have like flipped punks, crypto punks. punks, as recently as like the last couple months, and they bought them for like hundreds of thousands of dollars, and were like, I'm gonna buy this for 80K and sell it for 300. And I'm just like, I don't understand this enough to dip my toe into that. Like, honestly, I'm pretty conservative, and I may have even misused a couple terms, because I feel like I'm perpetually and woefully behind, because this space changes so quickly. NFTs are something that really blew up in 2021. And they were super hot in the first quarter of 2021. I'm just getting to the point where like, I'm going to start moving into altcoins and looking for a little bit more of my portfolio and newer projects that I think have good utility. Even up until the end of last year, I mean, I'm pretty much like mostly in Ethereum and Bitcoin and trying to learn as much as I can. So
what are some altcoins that you've been looking at?
The ones that right now, I tend to look at things in terms of like risk adjusted return. And from that point, I'm still like really bullish on Ethereum, actually, which you could consider an altcoin. I'm still really bullish on Ethereum, although it's a painful time right now. The Cosmos ecosystem is doing really well. I'm still looking into it and trying to understand it. But there's a lot of developers going into that space, a lot of money going into that space, and there's a lot of deliberateness in how they're trying to build out all the different pieces of the ecosystem. So, when I see like really smart people doing very practical things and trying to solve real problems, that is attractive versus like somebody who's just, it's very Ponzi-esque in that they're just trying to make money. I stay away from meme tokens in general. Although I really think that for folks that have a good feel for that, there can be a lot of money to be made there. I mean, just again, keep in mind, I just saw a Reddit thread yesterday where the guy was like, I put my wife's and my life savings into Dogecoin at 0.4 because everyone was saying it was going to go to $1. I didn't bother to look until after it went down and see that it had a $50 billion market cap. So basically what that means is everyone was like, Doge is going to $1, which was the meme saying. But if you consider that at 40 cents or whatever it was, or 0.04, I don't even know. I don't follow the price that closely. Probably it was 40 cents. That the market cap of Dogecoin was $50 billion. Just think about that for a second. That's like bigger than the GDP of small countries. You know what I mean? Like that's insane. And you think it's going to like quadruple from there, like what are you actually betting on? You know what I mean? So like, use your head. If you don't even understand what I'm talking about when I say market cap, you shouldn't be investing in Dogecoin, for God's sakes. Save yourselves, please stop. So there's a lot of stories like that, but I stay away from meme coins. There's a lot of what's called like layer one and layer two solutions. Two things that are really interesting to me right now are new blockchains where people are building stuff on top of, like Ethereum, but that serve different use cases. So there's like Avalanche is a really good example. Solana is a really good example. And you can look into these and learn about them and understand like what their strengths and weaknesses are and how many people are using them and if their numbers are going up over time. Like, that's the kind of stuff you want to look at when you're looking at these blockchains. Like, Avalanche is a really, really good bet, and it's got a lot of money flowing into it, and it's got a lot of like really strong use cases. So that kind of stuff is worth looking at. There's also a lot of bullshit out there, like that when you start to peel back just one or two layers of the onion, there's not much substance there. Like, there's not actually that many people using it. Like, sorry if you're into Cardano, but like Cardano is like one of those where it's just like, I don't feel like the numbers really stand up to the narrative around it. And Cardano has like one of those like Dogecoin narratives, I feel like, where people are just really excited about it and they don't really necessarily understand why. But again, there's a lot of folks that know a lot more about this stuff than me. I think, you know, there's like Terra Luna was another big one this year that folks like could look, got into it and saw that the numbers were blowing up really, really quickly. And it did really well this year. So there's a lot of new projects, again, that have a lot of utility. And I think if right now DeFi is another space where if you look for projects where people are improving the usability of DeFi and making it more accessible and making it safer and things like this, and you can invest in those things, I think over the next couple of years, that's going to probably pay off. So,
yeah, I'm curious. So for someone like you who has a, you know, decent amount of money in there, do you have any portion? I think you already answered no, but when would you think about, you know, putting some of that capital to use and loaning it out via these DeFi options?
I'm learning about DeFi right now as fast as I can, with the intention of figuring out a way where I can put all of my Ethereum and Bitcoin to work to create a passive income. I think we are still very early in the DeFi process where most people are scared of it and don't understand how to assess risk and don't understand how to use it. But for those folks that are doing it very well and do understand it, they're very much in the boat of like, if you're not making a passive income off your hard crypto assets, you're missing the boat.
Yeah.
And so, and there's, I think five years from now, that will be the case for everybody.
There's a marketing guy that I, you know, I'm on his email list and I've taken some courses from him, Mike Dillard, if you've ever heard of him. Mm-hmm. And he's recently really been promoting, I don't even understand what it is. And I usually, if I read one of his sales letters, I end up buying the thing. So now I'm just like, don't read it because you're going to buy it. Right. So, but essentially what he was talking about, was putting your crypto to work and building, it's like you build this robot and then the robot fucking makes you passive income from your coin. I didn't understand it at all until you started talking about it.
And yeah. I was actually thinking about today, if there was a way that you could automate it, because it gets a little complicated. Like when you're in a yield farm, for example, like there are actions you need to take to sort of like claim your rewards and things like that. And so there's a certain amount of like maintenance and monitoring you need to do over all the pools that you're invested in. And typically you want to diversify across several or more different pools, so that you, if something blows up on you, you don't lose too much of your overall portfolio. Again, unlikely unless you're taking wild risks, but still could happen. You know what I mean? Like I think that it's not unlikely that sometime over the next 10 years, there's like a major liquidity crisis in DeFi, because like it's the infrastructure there is not as secure or well understood or traditional as the stuff that we, like the banks, the way they run, that they've been doing the same shit for 50 years. Like it's a well-oiled machine. You know what I mean? Like there's a lot of different things that can go wrong when it's new and people are experimenting and that kind of thing. So yeah, I like one of the things I think that people can do again is use their Bitcoin and Ethereum as collateral, take out stablecoin loans against it, and then put those stablecoins into lower risk farms. A farm that might make 5, 10, 15, 20%. And again, if you have $1 million in crypto or $500,000 in crypto in the next 5, 10 years, that's making 20% per year off that is nuts. That's a high tech worker salary that you're making off that. Just letting it sit there and do nothing. You know, I mean, again, there may be some maintenance you have to do, but who knows, maybe in the next 3 years, they'll remove all that. It'll all be automated. So.
And so to do that now, you would have to learn about it and figure it out. It's not like you can call up your broker and be like, put me in there. Right?
Exactly. You have to manage. And that's probably one of the reason why the yields are so high right now. You have to manage your wallets. You have to understand how to send and receive crypto between different wallets. You have to understand moving tokens between different blockchains. And it gets hairy and precarious really quick. It's like almost something that I think you would need to become obsessed with for about 6 months to really fully wrap your head around the ecosystem. But like once you did, you could make more money there than anything, any traditional investment vehicle, I think. It's pretty insane, the opportunity in that space right now. So
Hugh's got a question. Hugh, do you want to ask or do you want me to read the question in the chat?
Hold on. Awesome. So when you talk about DeFi, since it's a new term for me, is it more like making partial loans, like the three of us would go in on one contract, or is it more like micro lending where everybody throws in like, you know, half a coin, and then if you lose that, you only lose, you know, half a coin?
So this is where you start to run, as far as the way that the lending protocols work in the background and what the relative levels of risk are. There are people that are far more knowledgeable about this than I. What I can say is that counterparty risk is still your primary risk when you're doing DeFi. So it's like, in other words, the risk of the other party, whoever they are, not being able to pay back the loan. And one of the things that is definitive about DeFi right now is you generally don't know who those people are, right? Because it's decentralized, your assets, your money goes into some kind of a protocol. And then in some cases, they're like algorithmically like giving out loans and looking for the highest interest rates and things like that. And so you don't necessarily know who's on the other side of the transaction. So, do with that information what you will. Some folks view that as higher risk. As far as making partial loans, I would describe that as like what the average liquidity pool is. So like in a liquidity pool, like imagine there's four of us in here. We all put liquid into like capital into a pool. And then the pool has an algorithm over the top of it that like determines who and where it loans the money to. And it seeks out the most favorable interest rates for us. So that would be like more like a partial loan where it's like how much of the counterparty got, or how much of your money did the counterparty get? I don't know. That would be kind of like a partial loan. But like, yeah, that, I guess you could call that micro lending as well, because like, again, I was just using an example where, I took a loan out against my Bitcoin. So like let's say they'll collateralize my Bitcoin at 40%. So I can take US dollar stable coins, 40% of those for, let's say Bitcoin's at 40K. That means they'll give me, you know, whatever that is, like, you know, 16K or whatever, 18K. That loan, you know, you could argue that that's a micro loan, right? And I don't know where that money's coming from. Somebody somewhere is loaning me that money. That's where I get a little nervous with, because it's like, it's a lot of it feels like magic. You know, and again, I think that's one of the reasons the yields are so high, is because, you know, whatever risk is inherent in that system, you know, like I, regardless of what you think about the banks, I think, again, what they do works, and it's been pretty consistent and stable over the last like 50 years. So, you know, that's, I guess, why they charge you to store your money with them now. So,
so if you do that, just wrapping my head around the loan thing. So if I have 40K in Bitcoin and I want a loan, I would give, what was it? 40%.
Give
my Bitcoin as collateral.
Yeah. Like, and it would literally be like, depending on how the platform worked, it would be like, you would stake your Bitcoin with them or whatever. And then they would be like, you're eligible to pull out this much money against your Bitcoin. And like you, it's like three clicks of a button, and it's like, boom, there's 20 grand in your account. Like, and the interest rate would be like painfully low. Like, like you would be like 3%. What the fuck? Like, so that's what people do now, is they'll take that loan. And again, 3%, 5%, 8%, whatever it is, it doesn't matter. Because if you then turn around and put those stable coins in a yield farm making 25%, you know?
Right.
Now you've just literally create your arbitrage, more or less arbitraging and doing similar stuff, what we were talking about with Airbnbs 6 years ago, you know?
Exactly. You're just printing money.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly what you're doing. You're printing money.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm pretty sure I feel like I might've done a terrible job answering your question. If so, I apologize.
No. That did it. I understand the concept. So okay. That's what I was trying to see.
Okay, cool.
So Aaron, why would people lend money against your Bitcoin at 3% and you can turn around and make 20 or 25%? Like, why wouldn't they be using their money to go make the 25%?
You mean like, why would they lend it to you when they could farm it themselves?
Yeah.
I mean, less risk, I guess. Eh?
Well, what's interesting is, and again, this is like right at the frontier of my knowledge of like the background and how it all works, but you may actually be getting one of the loans from somebody else that is farming, if that makes sense. Okay. That they've staked their liquidity into a pool, and that pool has loaned you that money.
But at 3%, you think they would be looking for something higher. But is it all about stability or all about security? Like, obviously, if they've got your Bitcoin as collateral, they're never going to lose, right?
Yeah.
But if you go and put your money into a, what you call it, farming, there's a risk of losing money.
Yeah, exactly. And that may be that for them, that may be like, again, 3% might not be the right number. So just to be clear, I've never actually done this. Like I'm still in the process of learning how to set up stablecoin farms right now. So I don't know what the actual loan interest rates are, but I know they're low, like lower than you'd expect. It's a good question. Like, why would they loan it to you instead of just farming themselves? There's probably a good answer there. One reason may be that the counterparty risk is less, to your point.
Yeah.
Like for them, that may be like because 5%, honestly, nowadays, if you're moving around hundreds of millions of dollars, 5% on yield on that is way better than still you'll get anywhere in traditional finance. It's not bad.
Secure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unsecured, but it's or, like,
well, no, good, but good, I mean, a solid 5%, like,
yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Like that might be the lowest risk investment strategy for them. Right. And like I said, like, what do you get? Like 0.3% now in a bank account, if you're lucky, 0.4%. So.
Yeah. Interesting.
I mean, I equate it. I come from real estate. So it's the difference between going to a bank and getting a loan and going to a hard money lender, right? Mm-hmm. Hard money lender is going to lend you more money at a higher interest, but they've got more risk. The bank, mm-hmm. they don't secure. So there's going to be people in the crypto space that just want to be the bank.
Yep.
I mean, it's very similar to using equity in your house to borrow money and take it out and put it in a higher risk investment.
It is. There's actually a new company that just did a big announcement this week that are saying that they're going to accept Bitcoin as collateral for down payments and mortgages so that Bitcoin investors can now use their Bitcoin as collateral to open up another investment into something that ideally will also appreciate.
How do they hold the Bitcoin in a way that they've got control over it and you have control over it?
I don't know. It's a good question.
Okay.
I don't know.
Some mechanism, obviously, that they put in place.
Yeah. Maybe you have to, like, again, staking is something that is often used for this purpose, where it's like you lock it into some kind of mechanism for a certain period of time. And that allows all kinds of interesting use cases for the folks that are accepting that. So yeah, but I don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah, because if you defaulted on your loan, they need to have access to your Bitcoin for collateral. Yep. But at the same time, you need to be able to protect your Bitcoin that they can't just come take it away. So
yeah. Yeah, who knows? I mean, I don't even want to speculate, but
that's what a trust fund is. So it must be some kind of an electronic trust fund.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Or like a dual signature wallet or something where both people can see what's in there and, you know, but you have to, it's locked for a certain period of time. Yeah. So I don't know.
So can you imagine getting into court and fighting it out with this lender and like, oh man, it could get really interesting.
Oh yeah. You're going to start seeing stuff like that in the next couple of years for sure. Court cases about that stuff where they have to figure all this shit out and like, okay, how do we rule on this? So yeah.
Did you hear about that court case where they were trying to figure out who the founder of Bitcoin was?
Yeah.
did anything come of that?
I don't remember like what that was actually. I remember a bunch of the early Bitcoin devs like had to go to court for stuff, And I there was like defamation and like other, I don't even remember what it was all about, but yeah, there was that. I remember that coming up in the case from like reading the news about it, that it, they were like trying to figure out if one of them was actually Satoshi.
Right.
Yeah. But I think that as far as I know, no one knows who Satoshi is. There are like leading theories, but yeah.
But we know who created Ethereum and a lot of the other altcoins. Yeah. We just don't know who created Bitcoin,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Okay. And is the person who created Bitcoin also the person who created the blockchain?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think that Bitcoin, if I'm not mistaken, Bitcoin was the first blockchain as we understand it today. Yeah. So I would guess yes, but I could be wrong on that. There might be some like cryptography guys out there who are like, we were working on this shit since the 1980s. Like there's always that, you know?
Right. So
he stole our idea, I guess. Fake right. Japanese guy stole our idea.
Yeah. I think that's so cool that we don't know who the actual guy is.
Yeah, it definitely adds to the legend, right? The culture. Yeah. So
just some gangster. He's like, I don't want any credit.
A lot of people think he's dead. That would be interesting. Because it's like also like one of the big questions, I think, is like, because you don't know how much Bitcoin is lost forever. Like there's estimates about how much Bitcoin is lost forever, right? Because if you had it on a thumb drive and you dropped it on your boating trip, that which by the way is now a meme in the community. I lost my Bitcoin in a boating accident / tax evasion. it's like, but sorry, IRS, I put it on a thumb drive and you know, I lost it camping. Like you can't tax me on it now. You know, it's just, it's like a real thing, but there's some percentage of Bitcoin that is gone forever. Like it's in it dumps somewhere or somebody died and like lost the passphrase or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
So, depending on what that is, I think when people start to realize like how much of that is gone, that's going to be a hard deflationary pressure on the price of Bitcoin too.
How would they figure it out?
I mean, the only way I think you can really figure it out is to look at the wallet addresses and see like which ones have just never moved anything. Mm. But even that isn't necessarily a sure thing. You know what I mean? Somebody could be just sitting there waiting for the right moment.
Right.
For a decade. You never know. But like, since the wallets are anonymous, you don't necessarily know whose they are. It's you can never be sure.
Anything else you wanted to leave us with, Aaron?
I'll just say one more thing, like do your homework if you want to get into this stuff. It is dangerous. You can lose a lot of money, and like I might have a matter of fact tone in my voice, but I still consider myself like just coming out of my amateur phase with this. So it's like there's a lot, and you have to really be careful and read and be careful who you listen to as well, because there's a lot of people out there like doing the YouTube song and dance marketing their favorite coin and stuff like that. And they may sound like they know what they're talking about, but like one thing I'll say, I'll just make a broad, maybe controversial statement, but like no one really understands this completely. And anyone who says they do is lying, because this is super new and everyone's still trying to figure this out to a degree. So just do your own research and manage your risk well. Like start with 5%, start with 10%, be careful. And then as you learn and feel the pain of just that little bit of your portfolio, you'll get better and better. And then you can start to sort of size in more, but just like allow yourself to learn and take it on as kind of like a fun personal project before just doing some crazy shit, like just putting all your money into fucking, you know, Shiba Inu or whatever. So
Shiba. Oh, speaking of, well, not Shiba, but one, you know, as I mentioned on the beginning of the call, you know, you don't actually make it in the space until you sell, right? Mm-hmm. Or you're farming and making passive income. But yeah. I found this website. I'm going to share my screen. So there's this site called ColinTalksCrypto.com.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially what this measures is the confidence that we're at the peak of the market. And I don't remember where I came across this, but it has these metrics down here. And if you click on each one of these are different graphs. Like for example, the percentage of Bitcoin search term on Google, right? Yeah. And you can look at this and it'll give you, you know, here's the peak back in 2017, and then you've got it, right? So this kind of follows the market.
That's really cool. Like a lot of those metrics are key metrics that I follow too, like Ruple, for example, the 1 second from the left on the top, that Ruple Nupple, these are good.
Okay. Yeah. And so basically what my plan is, you know, to wait for this number to get around, I don't know, 80, 90.
Yeah.
And sell, you know, a decent position or a decent amount of my position, and then just, you know, wait for the next sort of up and down. So what do you think about that strategy in general?
I think that that's a solid strategy. One of the things to be careful about is that imagine that a lot of these things are called technical analysis, right? And they're all great tools. But there's no panacea when it comes to the right combination of metrics to become a profit. And one of the things that is very interesting is that emotions still drive peaks and troughs. And one of the things that'll happen is when a piece of information is something that like the brilliant scientist guy discovers in his lab one day, and he sees the way the wind is blowing, and he tells his friends to sell at 20K, like your friend did, which is brilliant, by the way. Like most people lost their shirts and that, or like had to ride the bear market down. Like that was the first time I ever heard anybody that got clear instruction to sell at 20K. It probably happened elsewhere, but it was probably the minority case, right? That scientist becomes brilliant because he told his friends to all sell at 20K. And then for the next cycle, everyone's using his metrics because he predicted. And so then it's like, okay, the market adapts around that, right? So now a lot of the stuff you're looking at, I don't think most people are looking at. So I think that those are still really good indicators. And I'm not saying those won't call the top. I look at metrics like that. What I am saying though, is like one of the hard lessons I've learned is if you think that there's going to be some magic threshold where all of a sudden the clock strikes midnight and you're going to be like, all right, I'm selling everything, we're at the top. Like that will not happen. Like if you are playing that game, you are so much more likely to get caught with your pants down. Like it takes somebody that is extremely lucky to be able to do that, and probably also a genius. What you want to start doing is when you feel that number starting to go up and you start to feel that the euphoria is getting into the bloodstream, you can feel everyone going like, it's going to the moon. We thought it was going to crash last year, but no, it's like the Fed's going to keep printing and it's in this and that. Like start scaling out just 5% every month or whatever your scale out strategy is. Don't think of it as one momentous thing where you're going to sell out or buy in, all out, right? Like you want to like average out and average in. Now, again, the more compressed you can get that time frame, the more skilled you're demonstrating. But the longer you drag out that time frame, the easier it will get for you to not fuck up, if that makes sense. Right. Now, you will limit your gains probably because you'll have to watch it continue to go up probably once you start scaling out. But trust me, that's a hell of a lot better than getting caught holding the bag for 3 years, a hell of a lot better. So like I personally feel like one of my big mistakes of 2021 is all of my technical analysis told me that we were going to probably hit 100K and have a blow off top or higher in 2021. And as a result, I didn't scale out at all when we were at 60K, 57K, 65K. And now I'm sitting here and like, look at me, I'm holding the fucking bag. Like I'll have to figure it out. I'll be all right. But like, you know, now like what happens if I need to pay some bills and I have to sell $35,000 Bitcoin? That's going to be a sad panda moment for me, you know, totally. Because I was too greedy to fucking sell one at 65K, you know? So just be careful, right? Like learn from me. Don't do what I did.
Well, I feel pretty good about myself because I bought a Range Rover when it Bitcoin was like 55.
Nice.
So I feel good about myself now. I felt bad, you know, of course, like a little while ago. But then I also lost close to 20 by giving it to this fucking dude who just lost it all too. So whatever. Yeah. I'm still back to zero because the Range Rover wasn't about that. So
yeah.
You know.
But I really do believe that, again, over a long enough time frame, 5 years, 10 years, like you're no problem looking at $250,000, $500,000 Bitcoin. So like, I still think generational wealth can be made there. Just be careful and thoughtful about investing. It's still investing and it's crazier investing. Cause we're watching it right now, right? Like it goes down. Like we have like swings of like 5-6K a day on Bitcoin. Like, so that's 10-15% swings intraday.
Yeah. It's nuts.
Just be careful. Yeah. Don't try to trade that shit unless you know what you're doing. You will lose your money. Promise. So, all right, guys.
Dude, thanks so much, Aaron. And the guys, thanks for coming on and asking cool questions. Yeah. And
have a good one. Shit. And I'll try to catch up with you guys soon.
Thanks for listening. If you want more, go to innerconfidence.com. And don't forget to subscribe to this podcast for the latest episodes.